I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with the Deal. And today our guest is Len Tatey, a partner in the tax department at Cravath, Swain & Moore. Len, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, David. It's great to be here.
We're going to talk about several things on today's podcast, your background, how you ended up in law school and how you became a tax lawyer, and then focus on your practice as a tax lawyer, your expertise in spinoffs, how, as you've dealt with a number of those transactions, you've become comfortable delegating to younger lawyers, your maturation and the maturation of other lawyers as tax lawyers, and how, especially earlier in their careers, they should think about their career options. And finally, your family and music, for which you have a great passion. So to begin, tell us a little about yourself, your background, how you ended up going to law school and specializing in tax.
Sure. So I think if you talk to anybody who knew me in 7th grade, 10th grade, 12th grade, they would be very unsurprised to know that I am a lawyer now. They might be a little bit surprised to learn that I'm a lawyer working in New York City. There weren't a lot of people in the suburban public high school where I grew up who ended up sort of on that kind of career path, but nobody would be surprised to know that I had become a lawyer. I was very involved in high school in our mock trial program, and so I was doing very sort of advocacy litigation type stuff with the mock trial group. If you talk to somebody who I went to college with about the fact that I'm a lawyer, they might not be surprised, but it was not really a natural path for me. And I think they'd be stunned to think that I was a tax lawyer, because when I was in college, I did not do any of the traditional coursework or summer internships that you would do if you knew you wanted to end up in a Wall Street career. I didn't take any econ. I didn't take any finance. I didn't take any public policy classes. Instead, I took the history class. I was a history major. I took the history classes that interested me. I took the art history and music classes that interested me. I took the science classes I was required to take to graduate. And other than that, I was very heavily involved in the extracurricular life at Princeton, which is where I went to school. I was a musician and a conductor of the Princeton band, which besides playing music means you have to travel to all the football games and you have to travel to the basketball games and the NCAA basketball tournament and things like this. And I was also heavily involved in a dramatic organization. I know, David, that you went to Princeton, so you know what the Triangle Club is, but the Triangle Club was founded in 1891, and every year since then has written and produced its own original student musical every year. And I was the president of that organization my senior year, but I was in the pit orchestra. I was an actor. I was a singer. I was a dancer. I was a conductor of the pit orchestra. And it was a key part of the kind of campus cultural life. So I didn't do any of the things that one would have planned to do if one knew you wanted to go to law school and become a tax lawyer.
So after you graduated from college, you actually stayed on at Princeton for several years as an admissions officer, which is kind of a halfway house between college and the real world. When did you decide to go to law school?
Well, the point I was making about even my summer experiences fits in with that. Every single summer in college, I lived at home. I grew up near Princeton, and I worked as a tour guide in the tour office at Princeton, giving tours to prospective students, high school students, and their parents. I must have given 1,500 or 2,000 tours over the course of my time at Princeton. I gave Hillary and Chelsea Clinton's tour when they came through when Chelsea was looking at colleges. And I sort of figured out something then that I think I still apply in my life today, which is I had a captive audience of people who needed information from me. This was in the early days of the internet where it was hard to get information. And I had a lot of information to give, but I had to figure out the right way to communicate it to this group and give them something that was going to be usable for them to make decisions in their lives. And that's exactly what I do today with my client work in a field like tax. And so by the time I graduated, the only thing I was qualified to do was to continue talking to prospective students and their parents about going to college at Princeton. So I spent 3 years in the admissions office.
Why did you realize as a lawyer that performance is, in fact, a big part of being a corporate lawyer?
It is. And I think it's a big part of my strength and my development as a lawyer into my lawyer persona. Because when you get on a call, number one, you have to know your stuff. But if you don't know your stuff, you need to at least give the person you're talking to the confidence that you're going to figure it out. It's not quite faking it, but you need to give them the confidence that you are the right person to deal with this problem they are bringing you. And that confidence comes from knowing yourself that you can get it done. And so every conference call, every meeting is performative in that regard. And I think my experience with public performance or public speaking or however you want to think about it has given me tools that are frankly a little bit rare in the tax field. And so I take it as a huge compliment when people say to me, as they do with some frequency, wow, I've heard a lot of tax lawyers try and explain this particular issue or problem to me many times over the last 10 years, but I've never really understood it quite the way that I do now. So thank you. That's a huge compliment to me, but it's also a validation of the way I have developed as a tax lawyer.
And usually when we think about lawyers and performance, we think about litigators, we think about people who go to court. How did you decide to go to law school? And then in law school, how did you gravitate to tax?
Well, after a few years in the admissions office, my wife and I, we got married right after she graduated a year behind me, and we started a family right away. And I sort of needed to make a big decision about whether I was going to spend my life in academic settings, wearing penny loafers and striped ties and blue blazers all the time. And there's a certain sort of comfort and vibe to that, or whether I was going to do something professional. Like I said, my college curriculum wasn't necessarily geared towards pre-professional universe in any way. And we just sort of decided after talking about it that I would apply to law school and that we would consider it as a next step. And when we went down and visited UVA in Charlottesville, I think we were really convinced that it was a great next step for us as a family and also for my career, because I know you went to UVA also for law school. If Princeton had a law school, it would be a lot like UVA's law school. And we had all the orange clothes, so we fit right in. And we really felt like as a family, we could have three good years with decent quality of life while I was being a student, and we could figure stuff out after that. And we sort of expected that I'd come back to New York. So we sort of made a mental transition to stop being a kind of college family or an academic family and living that kind of life, and to at least put ourselves on a path to be in a more professional environment. And I remember saying to my wife, not everybody would feel this way, but I want to put on a suit and tie every day, and I want to go into an office in a big city, and I want to sit at a desk, and I want to work, and I want to see where that kind of discipline will get me. And I said that very early on in the process of thinking about this. And I mean, minus the suit and the tie now, after the pandemic, that's essentially what I'm doing.
And so how did you end up focused on tax?
Well, again, when I got to law school, I had no expectation that I would be gravitating towards even a transactional field. Like, I had no background in it, as I said. So I thought I would be studying the great constitutional questions of our time, maybe constitutional history, something like this. If I were really thinking about off the wall ways to do law, I might think, well, maybe I'll be a music lawyer or entertainment lawyer or something. But at the beginning of law school, I just kind of let the core curriculum happen to me. And then in the second semester of your first year at UVA, you're allowed to take two electives, which is a little bit unusual. And so in the fall semester, they bring everybody into all the 1Ls into an auditorium, and they have professors give little presentations about elective courses they're teaching the next semester. And they kind of make their pitch for their course. And one of them was a tax professor named Paul Stephen. And Professor Stephen, you know, made what I thought was a very sensible, logical pitch. And at that point in my life, I was thinking about things in sensible, logical ways. And the pitch was basically, if you're thinking of being a transactional lawyer, which by that point I was starting to get a little curious about, even if you don't want to be a tax lawyer and won't be a tax lawyer, it makes a lot of sense for you to have a very basic understanding about the way the federal tax system operates. And that's also true just as a citizen. And so, you know, of all the other things I was looking at, evidence or whatever other electives I could take, I felt like that was a good pitch and I bought it. So in the spring of my 1L year, I took tax. Now, the story would be really neat and tidy if I just said I fell in love with tax and I've never not wanted to think about tax again. But I wouldn't really put it that way. I really fell in like with tax. I enjoyed it. I liked the concepts. I didn't, you know, I think I got an A- in that class. I did fine. I liked it. And I was curious to learn more. So as I was thinking about my 2L year, first of all, I was thinking about interviewing at firms. And I sort of felt I would interview with corporate departments and tax groups. And I took international tax that fall with one of your good friends and now one of mine, Mitchell Kane, who's now at NYU, but back then was teaching at UVA. It was his first semester teaching. And I liked that too. And so that fall of 2003, I was taking international tax, which is an advanced class, with a new professor who was really energetic about the material. And I was interviewing with corporate and tax lawyers, and I was now beginning to see things clarify for me. I was being able to see that the following summer, I would be able to inhabit both of these kinds of worlds, the corporate world, the tax world, and more generally, the world of transactional deals. And I would get a lot more experience and understanding about what was the right pathway for me. That spring, I took corporate tax, and then I showed up at Cravath as a summer associate in 2004, and I split my summer between the corporate group and the tax group. I liked the people in both groups. I liked the work in both groups. By that time, I was really kind of convinced that I could do this tax stuff, that I could do it at a reasonably high level, that I had some decent aptitude for and affinity for it. And I really liked the idea of starting my career on that pathway. And I don't really remember worrying too much about the traditional concern of, well, what if you specialize? If you open this tax door, you're going to close all these other doors. What will you do after 3 or 4 years, et cetera? Again, I've never really made choices because I felt like 5 years from now, I was going to have better choices for that reason. Instead, I just sort of felt like right now, this is what I wanted to be exposed to. And I would leave for another day with a little bit more experience and a little bit more understanding, you know, what my choices were then.
Was there a specific deal or a specific time as an associate when you realized you were really good at this and really, really enjoyed it and wanted to have a law firm tax practice as opposed to going in-house?
Maybe not one moment, but over the course of my first 3 or 4 years, I did a series of spinoffs for Time Warner. And Steve Gordon was the tax partner on the deal. And Lauren Angelilli at the beginning of these deals was a senior associate. And she's now one of my partners and the head of the tax group at Cravath. And you know, the first was Time Warner's tax-free split off of the Atlanta Braves. The second was their spinoff of Time Warner Cable. And the third was the spinoff of AOL. And it was over the course of these three deals that I, and each of these deals takes 18 months or 2 years to do, that I understood like some of the deepest complexities of what tax lawyers like Cravath tax lawyers are doing. These spinoffs are very intense transactions. There's lots of tax sensitivity. There's a lot of money riding on being right. And as a result, there's a lot of focus on the tax from the highest levels of these organizations. So you're not dealing exclusively with the tax or finance function. You're dealing with general counsels and boards of directors and CEOs and senior management. And it was over the course of doing those three deals that I felt in my bones that I think I could do this for a long time. I think I like it. I think I want to keep learning about it. I want to keep being in these kinds of rooms where these sorts of deals are being done. And over time, I think the firm began to feel the same way about me, you know, because when you're talking about like coming up as an associate and thinking about staying along to make partner and to make a run for partner, the firm is thinking about those things too, right? And, and it's kind of like a question about like, should we get married? Do we want to make a long-term commitment to each other? And, you know, over the course of time, I think both myself as an individual lawyer who was thinking about his career and the firm as a business enterprise that was thinking about who was going to be part of the future generations of, you know, leadership decided that it was a good match.
And spinoffs have become something of a specialty. You've done a number of them in the last 3 or 4 years. Talk a little more about those transactions, why they're challenging as a tax lawyer. And then now that you're a partner, how you balance the need to have a command of the details with the fact that if you're working on more than one of these things at a time, you can't be completely immersed in every single detail.
It's a really good question, David. I mean, as I sort of said, I did maybe one spinoff a year for a couple of years. And since then, I've done several more. If you have one spinoff to do a year and it's always on the corner of your desk, it's a lot. And right now, this year, I'm working on four. And I'm also working on two or three other client matters that are essentially adjacent to spinoffs, you know, M&A that's in connection with spinoffs or dealing with companies that have been spun off. And so almost every day right now, I would say 2/3 to 3/4 of my time is about spinoffs. I don't quite know why that is, but when the first of these came, I said, okay, another year with a spin. That's great. And then the second one came and I said, well, that's going to be interesting. I'm not sure how I'm going to make that work. And then the fourth one comes and you're thinking, well, I'm going to need a lot of help. And luckily at Cravath, we have a great team and I'll talk about that. Spinoffs are for me exactly what I was looking for when I went into this field because I was worried about the specialization of a field like tax to some degree, but I also knew I wanted to do deals. And the tax parts of the deals were the most interesting for me. So I sort of viewed myself as getting to practice at the real interesting intersection of transactional Wall Street front page of the newspaper deals, but to work on those aspects of the deals that I found the most interesting. And when I was starting at the firm, one of the tax partners at Cravath said to a group that he viewed himself as a corporate lawyer with a tax skill. Now, I'm not sure what my corporate partners would think about that kind of characterization of us, but I've tried to internalize that during my career because I really think of myself as a deal lawyer. I've also learned when you go to cocktail parties and people ask what you do, if you say tax lawyer, you're going to have a pretty lonely time at the party. But if you say, you know, I do M&A deals, people are a little bit more interested, I guess. And spinoffs are that, because spinoffs are essentially one company, take a public company, that's going to break up businesses and become two companies. And the general rule is when a company or an individual disposes of an asset or a business, it's taxable. And the only exception to that rule is if you can meet all of the requirements for a tax-free spinoff. And there's a lot of them. And the reason why there is a lot of them is because Congress decided that if we're going to make an exception to this general rule that disposing of assets is taxable, we're only going to allow it when there's a bona fide good reason for a company to split into two pieces. And so they put in a bunch of requirements. But rather than being some sort of border that keeps deals out, instead what the requirements are is a menu, a pathway to achieve the tax-free result. And so when a company divides into two, there's important tax considerations at the company level about whether the company is going to recognize billions of dollars of capital gain and have to pay tax on that. And there's also issues at the level of the public company shareholders. Will the shareholders be taxed as a dividend when they receive the shares of this other business? Or are they going to get to receive those shares without tax? And that question is critical because if anybody is taxed in this scenario, they have to find the cash to pay the tax somewhere else because there is no cash in the deal. All they're taking is one share of parent stock and dividing it so that it becomes a share of parent stock and a share of this other company stock. And so it can't be taxable. It just can't. It's very rare for a spinoff to be planned to be taxable. And it's very rare for a spinoff that's planned to be tax-free to fail to meet tax-free treatment because it's so critical that it be done properly and carefully. And so my practice over the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 years has really gravitated towards these rules, these types of deals, and all of the tasks that come with them, dealing with boards of directors and senior management and the tax people and mobilizing a team internally and talking to the corporate lawyers about what the key issues are and getting the IRS to understand what we're doing and to issue private letter rulings. And all of those tasks require a great team of people. And this is what I think Cravath does, you know, better than anyone else, which is it brings not just partners, but associates, the best and brightest out of law school together. And we work on teams. So now, you know, for each of these spinoffs I'm working on, I might be working with another partner. And in our group, we just made two partners last year who are the same class here who are awesome tax lawyers and maybe two or three, sometimes four associates. And we do a very Cravath typical thing, which is we divide this huge transaction up into various component parts. And everyone on the team is responsible for different parts. And everyone on the team works, number one, individually, you know, in their offices on the aspects of the transaction that they're responsible for. And then in a group, once a day or a couple times a week, we'll come together in somebody's office or in a conference room and we'll all collaborate on what's going on in the deal and who's talking to this person at the IRS on this. And do we hear back from the client on that? And so it's nowhere near the monastic experience that I think some people think tax lawyers are, where you have the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain and you go and ask them questions, but only on your knees. Instead, it's a much more social and collaborative process. And I absolutely could not do what I do without the team we've got at Cravath.
And in terms of the practice itself, I mean, historically, tax is a far less leveraged practice than most practices. You just don't have as many associates working for each partner. How does that affect the associate's development? And what opportunities does it offer associates who may be working when they're junior much more closely with a specific partner than, say, a second year securities or M&A associate would be?
It's another great question. I've never been a second year M&A or securities associate, so I can't speak to that experience or compare it directly, but I can tell you my experience, I think, as an associate is very typical of a Cravath Tax Associates experience even now. And that is, boy, for those first few spinoffs, I was working very closely with Steve and Lauren, who are now, you know, my professional colleagues and my partners. And I was working 4 to 5 hours a day with them, many days, and rolling up our sleeves, going to meetings, talking on conference calls, talking after conference calls, drawing pictures, thinking about what's our best argument, what's the best argument against us. One of the things Steve used to say is, if we tried this case in a court with Cravath lawyers on both sides making all the best arguments, how many times would we win on this point? And that kind of mentorship and thinking about lawyering was amazing preparation for me. And it's because, as you say, the tax group is not quite as leveraged as others. And we all sit on the same floor at Cravath. And as I said, we have little conference rooms on our floor. It's much more social practice than you would expect. And I think for a young lawyer coming out of law school, especially if they're not entirely sure what they want to be doing 4 or 5 years out, the opportunity to work in our group for 1, 2, or 3 years and just see the types of deals that come across your desk in that period of time, it's such a broad cross-section of the transactions that the firm works on. And to have the experience of working, you know, at arm's length with our partners, I think it's a great way to get exposure to the transactional universe. In fact, at the end of my second year, I got a phone call from a client I had just done a deal with. And the client asked me to interview for a job at her company. And I was flattered. It's the first time this has ever happened to me. I was really flattered. And at the time, as I said, I was a second year associate. Lauren had just made partner. And there was one more associate in the group between me and Lauren. So, you know, we were very thin at the top. And I thought about it. I didn't talk to anyone at the firm about it, but I talked to my wife about it. And I thought about it. And I called the client back and I said, I just don't think I can right now. I mean, I've just started here. I've been here for 2 years. I've seen great stuff. Lauren's just made partner. There's no other real senior associates here except for one person. If I stay at this desk, again, going back to the idea of sitting at a desk in a suit and a tie, for the next 18 to 24 months, I'm going to see all sorts of amazing deals like the one we just did together and others. And I think I'm going to be able to grow more here than going in-house right now. And the client was very understanding, incredibly understanding about it. And 2 days after I made partner, you know, several years later, she sent me a note. She congratulated me and she said, aren't you glad you decided to stay? And I guess I was. But at the time, I wasn't thinking like, wow, there's no other associates here. So I've got a great runway to make partner. Instead, I was thinking about it in a more short-term way and in a more practical way, which was just that the experiences I was going to get in my role as a third and then fourth year tax associate at Cravath, working with these people on these deals, was sort of the best investment I could make into my professional future at that point.
And so that's a great way for associates to think about what they should spend, as you said, in your case, the next 18 to 24 months doing. If you talk to your own fourth year associates, or you're talking to, you know, end up talking to a fourth year associate at another firm, tax associate, how should they think about the decision to stay in law firm practice, make partner where they are, maybe go to another firm, or go do something else?
I want to answer that question, but first I want to think about like what I hear from law students a lot, because I speak to and interview a lot of law students. And I think when you're a second year law student and you're interviewing at these firms, unless you grew up in a family of lawyers and you know entirely what you're getting into, you have no idea. And you think you do, but the only lawyers you know are your law professors and the people you've met during the interviews that you're doing as a second year law student. And all of those people look the same. They all have blue or gray suits on. They all have red or blue ties on. They all like the firm they're working at. They all went to your law school probably. And it's nowhere near as enlightening as it seems. It's all very kind of flat. And I remember not appreciating that myself. I remember thinking at this point in life, hey, being a law professor seems like it would be really fun. And then it's like, oh, but being a law firm partner also seems like it'd be really fun. Like, those are the only two types of lawyers I know. And they both seem like, well, yeah, I'd like to do that. So when I hear a law student say to me, I'd like to be a tax partner at Cravath or a tax partner at a big New York firm one day, I understand it, right? But what I say to them is, that's not the way you should be thinking about life right now. You should be thinking about, what do I want my first 2 or 3 years out of law school to look and feel like for me? Do I want to be in a big city? Do I want to be sort of writing research memos, or do I want to be on calls with clients? Do I want to be in a big city, or do I want to be in a small town? Do I want to, what kind of tasks do I want? Do I want to be working with Steve and Lauren, or do I want to be left alone to do my stuff and then go home? Those are the ways to think about your life at that point. And then, and this is where I'll answer your question, when you're a third or fourth year associate, having done that, now ask yourself, do I want to be a partner at this firm? Like, I look at what Steve or Lauren or Len are doing. Do I want to be doing that, you know, 5 years from now? Do I want to be dealing with clients when they're annoyed about the work they're getting out of the firm? Or do I want to be recruiting new clients to come to the firm? Those are questions that you will be much more able to answer and process once you have experienced being a tax associate or a corporate associate. And when I talk to fourth year associates at Cravath about their future, that's kind of what I say. And when they say, well, you know, I think I might want to be partner here or otherwhere, I still sort of think it's not quite the right question. Again, I think the question is, no, what do you want like the next 3 years of your life to be like? Because, you know, partnership is still 3 or 4 years away. And if you make partner, you're still going to have like your first 5 years as a partner after that you're going to have to think about. How do you feel about that? So to me, the question is always a very practical one, which is, do I like what I'm doing enough to get up on Monday morning and do it every day? In other words, when I'm going through my emails on Sunday night, and I'm looking at my calendar for the coming week, do I have like a pit in my stomach and I just kind of dreading it more weeks than not? Or do I feel kind of energized about it more weeks than not? Because look, I have definitely had Sunday nights where I'm like, I really don't want to go to work tomorrow. Like, this meeting I'm going to have at 10:30 is going to be rough and I'm prepared, but I'm just not going to like it. It could go poorly or something like that. But most weeks I don't feel that way. And I think people really need to kind of internalize how they are experiencing the law. Because if you just put yourself on a people mover and you show up at Cravath and you do all the work and you put your head down and you do some more work, you know, one day you wake up, you're a partner at Cravath or some other place, and you really haven't thought a lot about, how did I get here? And do I like this? Can I do this for 25 years? And so I really like people to think a little bit more about what they're seeking out of their career and gathering the experiences and the insight to be able to make better judgments about what they want to be seeing over the next chunks of time in their career.
And so, Len, you actually have your own podcast about tax as well.
That's right. And I owe you a lot of credit for that, David. During the early days of the pandemic, I would go out in the morning for runs. And then, you know, it wasn't that busy back then. So I'd actually go out in the afternoon for runs also. And before I knew it, I was running, you know, 10 or 12 miles a day. And one of the things I started doing was gobbling up podcasts. And I heard your podcast, I heard several episodes of it. And I thought to myself as I was running, we could totally do this for tax lawyers. And I started talking to people about doing a tax podcast. And everybody like snorts at the beginning when you tell them that you want to do a tax podcast. They're sort of horrified at the idea. Who would ever listen to that? And in the end, we developed this podcast called On Tax. It's, you know, Cravath's only podcast of what we hope will be many. And I kind of do what you do, but I have on my podcast people who started their career essentially as tax people. And some of them are still doing tax. You know, they're heads of tax or they're working in the tax field, but many of them are not. And it's been a great opportunity to get out there into the world a little bit of awareness about sort of our profession, but also the kind of human side of tax. So it's very important to me that we don't talk about technical tax things on the podcast, because I feel like that the audience isn't really interested in that. And that's not our audience. Our audience is podcast consumers and law students and others who are curious about, you know, just kind of biography and how people live their lives. And we've gotten the most amazing reaction from non-tax people. I mean, I have people I don't know sending me emails saying, Well, you know, I work in corporate finance and I really didn't think I had the stomach for tax, but I love your podcast and I keep listening for new episodes. And even my kids have engaged with what I do in a different way. My kids will be wandering around the house with their earbuds and they'll see me and they'll pull their earbuds out and they'll say, "Hey, Dad, listening to your latest podcast. This is a really good one." And so it's been a great part of sort of the post-pandemic aspect of my professional life. And I owe you a lot of credit for that, David. So thank you for the inspiration.
Thanks. That's great to hear. You mentioned the beginning of the podcast. You and your wife started a family very early when, you know, in your first few years out of college. And you obviously have a huge range of interests outside the law. How do you balance those with your career? And which interests do you particularly focus on at this point?
Well, my wife and I now have 7 children, and we moved out of the city in 2008. To the town where I grew up in New Jersey near Princeton. And so since then, except for the pandemic when nobody was commuting anywhere, I've been commuting to New York City 5 days a week on the train. And it's a total drag. I mean, I'm able to send a lot of emails and get a lot of work done, but a helicopter would be better, I guess, but the train is what I've got. And just thinking about, say, just like 2017, before the pandemic, Monday morning, I'd get on the train at 7:30 or 8 o'clock. To do that, I'd leave the house at 7 or 7:30. And if I had a full day of work and a client dinner or a full night of work after that, I might not be getting home until 10 o'clock at night. That's kind of a bummer, but it's the life that we chose back then. And it's the life that we continue to choose essentially on a daily basis by keeping doing this. And what we try and do is, for many years, we try to have breakfast together when we were living in the city. And then, you know, one of the things I've learned is that work-life balance doesn't mean every day everything's in perfect equipoise. So we've tried to take vacations and spend time together as a family in that way. We try on the weekends, we try to ski every weekend in the Catskills. My wife is a ski instructor for adaptive skiers. And so we've tried to make it a priority almost every weekend, I don't know, since 2010, to go up there and ski with our kids. And of course, I'm working over the course of time on the weekends, but it's an opportunity for us every weekend reliably to get out of our normal routine and be together. And so even when I can't ski on a Saturday because I'm working all day, we'll still get together for dinner. And, you know, now my kids are older. We've got kids away at college. We've got kids away at boarding school. We've got some kids still at home. And we've entered a new phase of, okay, where do we have to go this weekend for parents' weekend or for somebody's music performance or a football game at the college that we want to go to together as a family? Or we love going to Eagles games in South Philly. And sometimes we'll get tickets for that and we'll do that as a family. And, you know, then over the summer, we like road trips and we'll try and drive cross country or we'll take a trip together as a family to the beach and spend a week there. So we've tried to appreciate that you make a lifestyle choice when you interview for and stay at law firms like Cravath, but also you have an opportunity to have cool experiences and to spend time together as a family, and you need to capture those and take full advantage of those. And I think we've done a pretty good job of doing that, you know, but then there are some vacations where I work a lot and I feel like it's just way too out of whack. And sometimes it's more in whack than out of whack. And that's good, too.
And then finally, your passion for music.
Yeah. So I it's mostly in my blood, I guess. My mother was a professional opera singer at the City Opera in New York back in the late 60s and early 70s. And when I was growing up, we had a lot of music around the house and we had a lot of my mom's orchestral scores and records. And so I would sit, I suppose this makes me seem like I was well on my path to being a tax lawyer even back then, but I would sit on the couch and I would look at an orchestral score of, you know, Beethoven symphony or something, and I would listen to the music and follow along. I mean, this was, I guess, a precursor for conducting the Princeton band or conducting a pit orchestra. But I found that to be a really great escape because there was a lot of complexity and nuance, and you could see on the page that a big crescendo was coming, and then you could hear it on the music and you could anticipate loud parts and quiet parts. There's some sort of real satisfaction to how it all fits together on the page. I think that's actually pretty similar to tax law, because when you open up the tax code and you need to kind of assemble all these different pieces, keep your thumb over here and go to the regulations over here, in the end, it all kind of fits together. And I have always had this deep affinity for music and appreciation for music. I am a reasonably talented musician, but nowhere near, you know, professional level. I mean, I can sing and I can play the trombone a little bit, and I still can play by memory the five piano pieces that I learned when I was 10, but that's all I can play on the piano. My kids, on the other hand, have a real deep ability in music. Piano players, guitar players, singers. Some of my kids are recording Spotify albums in college. And one of my kids is away right now at a visual arts program. And so I've been able to sort of share that with them. And as a result, as a family, right, all of us, myself, but all of us are sort of equally at home in the stands at a Philadelphia Eagles game in the fourth quarter against the Cowboys and in the orchestra section of the Philharmonic or the Metropolitan Opera or an art museum. And one of the most rewarding things as a parent now with older kids who are kind of making individual choices and following their individual interests and passions is when everybody is home. And over the past few years, everybody's been home a lot. One of the kids will sit down at the piano or get a guitar out. And even the kids who don't have as much musical ability will gather around and sing or listen or participate or get energized. And for my wife and me, it's been very rewarding because it's always been a kind of a loud house, right? But when it's loud with that kind of noise and sort of energy, it's pretty rewarding.
Len, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been great to be here, David. Thank you.
For Drinks with a Deal, I'm David Marcus.